Welcome to Crafting Solutions to Conflict, a podcast exploring how to deal effectively with conflict, actual and potential, good and bad. Engaging guests discuss a range of insights, and I cover tips and topics based on my 35-year fascination with conflict and my experience helping people with it. I'm your host, Jane Bettel, and my goal is to share a perspective on conflict that is both practical and positive. My guest today is Bill Treasurer, the Chief Encouragement Officer at Giant Leap Consulting. We talk about courage, its role in the workplace, and positive conflict. Hello, Bill. Thank you for joining me on the show today.
Jane, I'm really looking forward to the time we're going to spend together.
I know there are a number of different angles that you can talk about. And of course, my primary interest is a practical and positive perspective on conflict. We touched on a couple of things when we chatted recently, and I'm looking forward to hearing your thoughts on some of those topics. First, will you tell us how you came to be where you are today professionally?
Well, I appreciate the opportunity. If I rewind my career back far enough, I had an unusual job where I was leading a troop of athletes, believe it or not, around the country performing aquatic entertainment productions. I was a member of the U.S. high diving team, where we were regularly diving from 100-foot platforms into little pools that were 10 feet deep. Before that, I was a scholarship athlete at West Virginia University. Springboard diving was my sport. So now I'm leading this troop of athletes, the U.S. high diving team. And one of my divers confronted me and said, "If you ever talk like that again, I'll walk, because I don't need the job that bad to be treated as poorly as you just treated the team," because I was the captain of the team. And I got defensive, and I said, "Hey, man, I'm your boss. I'll treat you any way I want to. You work for me, not the other way around." And the more I thought about it that night, Gandhi said, "The truth only hurts if it should," and it hurt. I knew he was right. I had no idea who I was as a leader. I was like trying to emulate the boss that I had had before me, the boss before that. And ultimately, I was like channeling my dad. So that person's feedback set me on a path. I started reading books on leadership. I got interested in the topic. I decided to go to graduate school. I did my thesis on leadership, and then I got into consulting, worked for a couple of boutique consulting companies. Then I worked for a large one, Accenture, one of the world's largest consulting companies. And then about almost 20 years ago, I started Giant Leap Consulting, a courage building company. And it's all because of the courage that that guy had some 30 years ago to call me on my lack of leadership.
I have to ask you, did you ever have any more contact with this young man? Do you have any idea what paths his life took him through?
You know, that's a really great question, particularly in the age that it's so easy to reconnect with people. I did write about him. His name is Steve Willard. And we worked for the rest of the summer. And I acknowledged in a future book the impact that his words had had on me. But you know what? I've never circled back. I've not connected with him. I've connected with some other divers and such. But I don't know where Steve Willard landed. So that will be my call to duty as a result of today's session.
Okay. It was just something that came to mind, that he had such an important influence on what became essential work for you.
It did. And I credit Steve Willard. He was a little bit older than me. And I think the other divers were too afraid to say that to my face. But he didn't need the job that as badly as maybe some of the other divers. But I really have always appreciated that. So I need to reconnect with Steve.
Well, you are hitting on a couple of words that I know provide opportunities for fabulous conversation. One, feedback, and the other, fear. What can you tell us about what you have seen in your work related to those things?
Well, what I can tell you what I've seen and what I've personally experienced. Whenever I've gotten tough feedback that stung my ears and that my initial response was to reject it or to come up with an excuse to assuage my own you know, sense of guilt or shame. Normally, if I sit with it long enough and I come to recognize the truth of the feedback instead of getting defensive about it, usually that feedback serves me, and often in profound ways. I remember one time a boss of mine gave me some good feedback and about what I needed to do differently and perform better. And it was normal stuff. And then he told me to close the door. It was like, uh-oh. He said, there's one other thing I want to tell you, Bill. He says, you're in your, and this is, I'm 57 now, but I was in my mid-30s at the time. He said, I want to tell you something that I'm starting to see, and my fear is that other people are going to see it too. And if they do, it's going to plateau your career unless you do something about it. He softened it, in other words. Yes. And then he made it so my ears could hear it. And then he said, Bill, I'm worried that you're starting to become a brown noser. Oh. And those were the words he used, and it really stung. I was like, oh, man, what do you mean, boss? Hey, you got a nice tie. And he didn't laugh, right? He's like, Bill, if you're laughing at my jokes harder than they are funny, then not only is that dishonesty, but it's actually manipulation. You're trying to get something out of me through a false friendship. He told me, you know, he understood it. He's like, you're in your 30s. You've got sharp elbows of ambition. You're trying to get ahead. So you're always hanging out with the people that are a few levels above you. And in your role as an executive coach to some of these people, I understand it. But what you're doing is you're alienating your own level, which are middle managers, and you're not building relationships there. So it was really great feedback. And I thought about it. I was driving home that day, and I was like, I'm a brown nose. But I can do something about this. But I knew the truth of it. I knew that I tended toward people pleasing behavior. And in the 90s, like, I thought that the word schmooze was a good word, and I realize now that it wasn't a good word. So what I found, Jane, to your point, is that sometimes when you have that hurtful feedback or that it stings, he wasn't trying to deliver it in a hurtful way. Right. And it matters who the person is giving the feedback, right? Yes. Like, I had total respect for him. I knew he cared about me. So he had put caring in me, over the years. So I knew it wasn't him trying to be bigger than me or make me feel small or rub my face in the dirt. He was doing it to hold me to a higher standard. It ultimately made me a better, more confident professional because he was giving me permission to be more of a truth teller and not a butt kisser.
Yes.
You know, I'm so thankful. And that is a person that I've told. His name is Heinz Brannon, and he was my managing partner at Accenture, and he was my boss. And he remains a mentor to me even 25 years or even 20 years since I worked for him.
Well, that's cool. Bill, how often in your work since then do you see people who, without any training or real focus on getting better at doing feedback, are able to do it well?
That's a good question. I suppose that there are some people who are sort of naturally graceful or naturally diplomatic and not overly diplomatic so that they don't water down their words to the point of diluting the message. There are probably some people who just seem to have a way with words. But on balance, I find that people have to be taught.
Yes.
And to use language that doesn't put up defenses, language that I would call language of reception versus language of defensiveness. Mm-hmm. Because if a person sort of wags their finger at my face saying, you know, you need to change.
Thanks.
Yeah, exactly. I'm likely to bite that finger off, right? But if a person can sort of hold the mirror up to the other person and help the other person see the incongruency between what they say they value and the gap with how they're actually acting, and they're not doing it in an indicting way, but in a way that invites the person to see themselves based on their own words and actions, that person becomes much more receptive to the message and much more likely to change.
Mm-hmm. And then I guess the flip side is the person who is sometimes forced to listen to the feedback. I think that's frequently a challenge, as I must listen to this whether I want to or not. How can that person do a better job of receiving it and holding back on the defensiveness?
My first blush answer would be that the context matters. Mm-hmm. If that feedback is being given to me in a culture, in an organization, for example, and it's a culture where, you know, I think of McKinsey, the great consulting company. They talk about an obligation to dissent, that's part of the culture. which means that the lowest ranking person in the room can absolutely disagree with the highest ranking person in the room. In fact, they have an obligation to, when they have some factual basis, to be in that disagreement. If somebody exists in a culture that feedback's expected, that feedback is part of the growth mechanism, that moving into discomfort and uncomfortable conversations is actually healthy and that the culture values it, then that person is going to see that, look, that's part of the path to getting ahead around here, is being able to sort of take it when somebody gives you feedback, and they're not doing it, again, to make you be small. They're making it to pull out something more in you and help you be better and raise to a higher standard. So if you're in the cultural context that supports it already, it's way easier. Mm-hmm. But if you just sort of get lambasted with feedback in a culture where the culture hasn't been sort of based on that, or it doesn't hold it as a cultural value, you're way more likely to reject it and fight it and see the other person as trying to compete with you as opposed to trying to make you better.
Yes. Well, I think from your work and your emphasis on courage, I'm going to have a guess that both the giver and the receiver might need to have some of that.
That's a really keen insight, Jane, that it takes courage on both fronts. So, for example, I told you about Heinz Brannon. I'm sure it took courage for him to say, close the door. And he had probably been holding this feedback for a while. And then he gives it to me. And he probably, you know, had some anxiety about giving me that. That's a tough moment to give somebody, even though they're at an impressionable age in their career, even though he knew that I needed to hear it, any human being is going to hesitate giving that sort of stringent, hard feedback. Sure. On the other hand, it took courage for me to receive it and to be able to ingest it and for me to not be able to reject it. So you're right. You know, the central aspect about courage is that courage is uncomfortable. When you're in a courageous moment, and for your listeners, as you just suggested, my work is courage building. I consider myself the chief encouragement officer of my company, and courage building is one of our URLs, for example. So yes, we do a lot in the area of helping people and organizations be more courageous. And one of the central lessons that we share with people is that courage is found in discomfort. I love this quote by Ginni Rometty. She's the CEO of IBM. And she said, comfort and growth don't coexist. Comfort and growth don't coexist.
Wow.
So if you want to grow, progress, and evolve, and if you want to have stronger relationships, and you want to grow in your career, you have to be willing to move into a discomfort zone, not a comfort zone.
Yes.
That, and part of that is the feedback sharing. That's an uncomfortable place to put yourself and situate yourself in. And yet it's so essential to human growth and strong bonds of relationships.
I'm sure you can't sum this up in a word or two, but where do people begin to build their courage, sustain their courage, find a way to take it?
What I tell people to do is to reflect on the times in their lives when they challenged themselves to get through something hard, challenging, and scary, and they persisted. And they persevered, because courage doesn't stop, right? Like that's one of the hallmarks as well. When you are facing a fearful or anxiety-provoking moment and you turn away from it, then you're, you know, I hate to use such a loaded word, but that's what cowardice is. Mm-hmm. But the differentiator with courage is to act despite the fact that you are afraid or uncomfortable. So there's a level of perseverance and persistence that comes with courage. And if anyone, by the time they get to middle age, can be able to look back at a few instances in their lives when they did just that. You know, I talked about Ginni Rometty from IBM. Another person I've been fortunate to have worked with is Sarah Blakely, the founder of Spanx. And Spanx, as you know, makes women's shapewear, and they're a billion-dollar international retail enterprise. And the way that she puts it, she wrote the foreword to one of my books, Courage Goes to Work. And she said that in any situation where she was afraid but kept on moving, you could cross out the word afraid and substitute it with the word courage, because that's what it means. So she said, I was afraid, i.e. courageous, when I knocked on the doors of textile mills begging them to manufacture my new footless pantyhose.
Yes.
I was afraid, i.e. courageous, when I started Spanx with $5,000 in savings. I was afraid, i.e. courageous, the first time I was a guest on the Oprah Winfrey Show.
Right.
So anybody could do the same thing. Write down a few paragraphs when you were really afraid And you can even use the word afraid. But as long as you kept on moving, now review those paragraphs and cross out the word afraid and put the word courageous, because that's what it is. So the central point of this is that courage is fearful.
Yes.
Courage is not fearlessness. Courage is fearfulness, but it acts despite the fact that it's afraid.
Keeps going. Talk to us some more about this idea of fear. So I'm thinking a couple of different things. I'm thinking first, we've talked a little bit about the internal struggle, the idea of my own fear and how to overcome that with courage and movement. But also I'm curious about, related to the idea of feedback, this idea of fear within the workplace of, what if I do the wrong thing? What if this is not the culture that I'd like it to be and I do something wrong? What if I say something or react to something in a way that will cause me professional harm? How does someone deal with that sort of thing with courage?
So one thing that to know is that fear is also useful, right? There's a reason that we have fear. There's a little piece in your brain called the amygdala. It's actually bilobal. You have it in both sides of the brain. And the amygdala, it's literally the Latin word for almond, because it's about the shape and size of an almond.
Yes.
And the thing to know about the amygdala and the fear button that you have in your brain is the reason that it's there is to prevent harm and danger. So one of the reasons that we wake up in the middle of the night, if we hear a loud noise downstairs or even a faint noise, and we wake up with adrenaline, is it's your body's protection mechanism. There might be harm coming your way. So not all fear is bad. Mm-hmm. Some level of consciousness that if I say this thing in the organization and the organization believes this way, and now I know I'm going to be saying something impolitical that walks outside the belief system of this organization, you in fact may be right. You might suffer reprisal. And so that sublimation of your instinct in that culture may actually be a warranted action, because your intuition is, and your fear button is telling you, hey, if you do that, you might, you know, suffer the consequences of harm and danger. Now, having said that, I think that more people suffer from the opposite, which is they bite their tongue too much.
Yes.
They don't raise their hand and extend themselves enough because of sometimes the myth of the fired person, that they're all like, you know, everybody in the organization is like, well, you better not speak up because, you know, so-and-so got fired when they opened their mouth. And then if you really dig around and you investigate that one person who got fired, there were multiple other factors. It wasn't just because they said something that was impolitical at the time. So I think that for a person in an organizational setting, one thing that they can do is to have a conversation with their boss, whether it's that performance review time, which is normal to give feedback at that time. Hopefully they're giving it more frequently than that. But to sit down with your boss and say, boss, hey, I just need to know, there's going to be times where I imagine you actually want me to disagree with you because it will help us, you know, make a better decision. It will advance your goals. And in those times where I need to say something that disagrees with you, can you give me some coaching on how to do that so that you don't receive it as disrespect of your authority? And almost any boss that you work with is going to give you some coaching. They're going to say, yeah, sure. Hey, that's a good idea. Actually, if you see that there's 50 items in my to-do list, or if you see me prepping for the board meeting, or if you see me coming out of the board meeting with a grimace on my face, that's not the time. Right?
Yes, right.
To give me the disagreement. Or, you know, or if we're in a meeting and we have the whole team there and you have a counter idea is good and it's welcomed and you'll see from my behavior that I'm receiving it. On the other hand, if you're going to take a stand right there in the team meeting and the stand is against me, I'd prefer to know that beforehand. So the coach leader should give you some coaching on how to disagree with them, so that they don't see it as disrespect of authority, which is a lot of the prism that a lot of people would see disagreement as.
Bill, there's so many gems in what you've just said. I'm trying to remember all of them. I think one was the idea of taking the initiative. Mm. One was the idea of it's a conversation. It's not a confrontation with your own boss.
Right.
It's not a speech where you announce things about the way you feel the two of you should have interactions where you differ. And Well, there are too many. I may have lost one there. But I love the idea of there is nuance to this. It's not all black and white, that you could never disagree, or you must always have a forceful take a stand approach, but that it's a give and take conversation in advance and ongoing.
Absolutely. Yeah, it takes maturity. It takes calling forth the adult in both people. It takes recognizing that your boss is not your enemy. And if you feel like your boss is your enemy, then you have to really question, do I need to be in that organization?
Right.
Or is there something that I could do to try to improve the relationship? Somebody told me a long time ago that relationships are not 50-50. You know, we like to think, well, I'll uphold my 50 if they just hold theirs up first. But really, somebody told me, and it's always stayed with me, that relationships are 100-100. And I have to give my 100%. I have to sweep up my side of the street. I hope that that influences the other person to, you know, sort of move in my direction. But if it doesn't, I can't really control that. What I can control is my own actions. Am I acting out of my integrity? Am I acting in good faith? Am I acting with decency? Have I cleaned up my side of the street?
And as you say, it's both sides. It's the boss who can give direction and coaching without, and I know I saw this word in one of your books and it sang out to me, without intimidation.
Right. Yeah. Intimidation is sort of really old school, old style of leadership. And still so many people in the workforce, unfortunately, use it. And a lot of times it's like me, right? Like when I told you the diver confronted me on, I was using an old style of leadership because I did it by default. I wasn't paying attention to who I wanted to be as a leader or who my people needed me to be as a leader. All I was doing was acting on what I had seen other people do in the past. And so that makes you sort of a puppet to the past. And in some respect, and maybe this is provocative, Jane, if a person is conscious that that's how they are as a leader and that that's their style, and if they are okay with it, then I'm a little bit better with that. Like if you self-evaluate, you understand that this is your style, it works for you, and you are comfortable in your own skin, and you can look at yourself without any feelings of guilt when you look in the mirror, then to some degree, I'm okay with that. But if you have never done any self-evaluation or reflection of yourself as a leader, and now you're adopting that as your leadership style, I'm not okay with it because you're sort of oblivious as a person.
What a wonderful kernel for us to end on. The time has flown, but that's a great thing for folks to take a moment to think about, I would say. Bill, if people would like to learn more about your work and get in touch with you, how would they do that?
Well, first of all, let me thank you for inviting me to be part of this wonderful conversation. And your listeners can find me at couragebuilding.com, billtreasurer.com, and they can always send me an email at btreasurer@giantleapconsulting.com.
And I will ask you once again to tell us your imaginative and positive title there.
Chief Encouragement Officer. And the good news is anyone can be one. Just take your own courage and help activate the courage of others.
Fantastic. Thank you, Bill. It's been great fun talking with you.
Likewise.
Thank you for listening. If you enjoy the Crafting Solutions to Conflict podcast, please share it, leave a rating or review, subscribe through one of the major apps. For anyone new to podcasts, here's something you may not know. Subscribing is free. You can also find the show at craftingsolutionstoconflict.com. Comments or ideas? Let me know. Until next time, I'm Jane Bettle.